This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie. I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here on this beautiful Saturday afternoon to be the managing partner of your life. And I look across from me and I see Carrie Kasem right back here in the studio with me. We're not talking Bitcoin. We had a great show on Bitcoin last week, Carrie. You missed it. You were
what
here.
What are you talking about?
I'm just kidding. You were here, but
I'm
going to
spend my money where...
Don't do that.
No, I'm going to. I swear, I'm telling you, there's going to be... There's some... What do you call it? Cyber currency
that... You better know what it is.
That, yes, that I am going to invest in. I think that it's smart.
I will not comment on that.
Not much. Not much. But look, if you would have invested in Bitcoin, if you would, I did.
I told you that.
A multi-million. You did not. And you would have been multi-millionaire. Not that. Maybe more to add to more millions.
Let me say this, Carrie. I like to keep an open mind on all issues, whether it's Bitcoin or whether it is the Charlie Beck resignation. Can you believe that?
I mean,
what a shock that he had 2 years left on his tenure as the chief of police for the LAPD.
It's not shocking to me. I don't know why it's shocking. Why is that shocking? He's been taking it, you know,
well,
like
if
there's
I came
been a
out
lot.
And I said I'm no longer the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, even though I have time left in my career. It's a little bit surprising.
Well, I wouldn't be able to point to all these different things and why and maybes and all the things that have happened to you throughout the years that would kind of allude to, hey, you know what? There is a reason why.
Okay, well, we'll see. We're going to talk about that today. Folks, we have a jam-packed show. You do not want to go away. If you're driving, just stick it out for the next hour, because later in the hour, we are going to speak to Greg Barker. Greg Barker is a phenomenal documentary filmmaker, and he has just come out with a new film called The Final Year, and it details the life and times of President Obama, along with John Kerry, Samantha Power, and a couple of other of the foreign team that was struggling through a year before Donald Trump was elected, and he was there with them, following them, and the film just came out. He is an incredible filmmaker, been called a filmmaker of artistic and political consequence by the New York Times, and that will be Greg Barker coming up a little bit later. First, though, we're going to talk to Joe Dominic. Joe Dominic is Associate Director of the Center of Media, Crime, and Justice at John Jay College, and he's the West Coast Bureau Chief of the Crime Report, author of two books on the LAPD. His first was To Protect and to Serve, and the latest book is Blue, the LAPD, and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. He this week came out with an article called The LAPD's Charlie Beck, A Chief for a Transformed City. We're going to hear why Joe thinks Charlie Beck has done a good job, and then we're going to hear another perspective. We are honored today to have with us Malina Abdullah, who is professor and chair of the Pan-African Studies at Cal State University, LA, and she was one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, and she continues to serve as a Los Angeles chapter lead, and she often contributes to the national leadership. She spoke at the Women's March last week. So it's going to be interesting to hear Professor Abdullah talk not only about Charlie Beck and the LAPD, but also about the Women's March. Before we get to Professor Abdullah, we want to welcome to Gervie's Law right now, Joe Dominic. Joe, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you very much, Alan.
It is great to have you on. Now, you have written a pretty powerful piece on Charlie Beck, came out this week, and I got to know, why do you feel so much respect for Mr. Beck and for the LAPD and what has gone on during his tenure as chief of LAPD?
Well, because I've been covering the Los Angeles Police Department for 30 years, and I know how bad it was and has been. My first book came out in 1994, and it was extremely highly critical of the Los Angeles Police Department and the way it policed, especially in African-American, Latino, and poor neighborhoods around the city. My second book was also a recapitulation of how bad the LAPD had been, how it continued to still be bad under former Chiefs Willie Williams and former Chief and the chief after him, Bernie Parks. But the second part of the book is about when Bill Bratton, who was a famous reform commissioner from New York,
right,
came to Los Angeles.
Has
and
the same accent
the
as you do.
Of the Los Angeles Police Department. He was the mentor to Charlie Beck. Charlie Beck became chief when Bratton left, and Beck has done, I think, a spectacular job.
Okay, Joe,
of changing the culture of the Los Angeles Police Department that everybody thought could not be changed.
So the important question is, how has he done that? Because a lot of people will say that LAPD has had their problems. There are a lot of issues, racial issues primarily. And, you know, in your article, you talk about some of the things that he has done that you believe has really helped LAPD. How do you, as a veteran reviewer of the LAPD, comment or how do you answer those naysayers that say Charlie Beck has not done enough for instance, minorities?
Well, I think he has. He's done a lot for minorities. And let's understand that that police departments are very complex organisms, and they are very, very rigid and mired in the past, and that's the way they want to be. Police are conservatives by the nature of their job. And what Charlie Beck did was he understood that the Los Angeles Police Department cannot be the same police department that was reviled around the world for the beating of Rodney King and for causing two of the worst riots of the 20th century. And that it had to change. And he was smart enough to understand why it had to change, and it was because the city has been totally transformed from the kind of white conservatives who dominated the city for so long into a multicultural, multi-ethnic, liberal city that didn't want the kind of policing that Daryl Gates and other chiefs had been providing. And so what he did was he said, we're going to change, we've got to change the culture of the Los Angeles Police Department, which is a long-term project, Alan. It's not something that can happen overnight, but it's happened now to the extent that I think we should celebrate what Charlie Beck has done.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think he's stepping down early? Why?
Well, because it's the right time for him. He's going out into, on top. Now, he's not going out on top as far as Black Lives Matters and other groups who are pushing the envelope in one direction, and they're necessary. But if you look at the possible, he retired because he has done all that he can do. Another 2 years would simply be superfluous for him.
Do you
think he's got other things to do?
Well, maybe so, maybe not. But do you think that a whistleblower lawsuit that hit the LAPD recently had anything to do with it involving Captain Lillian Carranza?
No, that had nothing to do with it, and that's been totally discredited.
Why do you say that?
You know, because I investigated it. I looked into it.
Yeah.
And Beck had a press conference and explained exactly what happened, and we haven't heard any more from her. I mean, this is the fact, you know, the things that she was saying were exactly the opposite of kind of what's been happening in the department.
Well, wasn't she saying that there was basically fake news that the LAPD was putting out regarding reduction of crime rates and other issues that the police are supposed to be really upfront with?
Yes, but she didn't offer any proof.
Maybe that's what discovery. I don't know. I mean, you know, you're the expert, not me. But obviously, we're going to have to hear what the proof is, because it certainly could be defamatory if she is saying that this stuff actually happened and it didn't.
Yeah. Look, Alan, I'm not here to carry Charlie Beck's water or anybody's water. As I said, I am somebody that's been critical of American policing and the Los Angeles Police Department for 30 years. I'm just telling you what I understand, that what my reporting has showed is actually happening. You know, I want to see progressive change in the Los Angeles Police Department, and I believe that's what Beck has provided.
And you don't have a dog in the fight, do you?
No, I don't. Certainly not.
And when you look at crime rates and everything, you're trying to look at the statistics and any advancements. I mean, we talk about, I think you mentioned the fact that the police are now under more scrutiny. There's more transparency with certain types of cameras that they may be wearing, that we can see what they're doing when there's an arrest or a stop on the freeways.
Mm-hmm.
Are those things that you look at to try to understand whether or not there's some progressiveness in the LAPD?
Here's two progressive things that happened. In 2015, there was a lot of I think legitimate criticism of not just the number of police shootings in Los Angeles, but the types of shooting. They were kind of a holy cow, I can't believe they just shot that guy shootings.
Yeah.
And the LAPD has always been a trigger-happy organization. So Beck worked with a very liberal police commission and a very conservative police protective league, the union, and they got a body camera.
Right, the body cameras.
And every LAPD officer now has a body camera, and there's cameras mounted in their patrol cars.
And that theoretically should help. You know, we have to wrap it up, but, I think that's a good point, that when we talk about these kind of difficult-to-prove issues, having transparency, having the ability to gather evidence is much more, I would think, really preferred than things that happen behind closed doors when we can just surmise. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Make one more point.
He also
helped to pass a new shooting policy in the LAPD, a de-escalation policy, which teaches officers how to avoid getting into situations where they have to shoot somebody because they're afraid for their lives.
Right.
So this was very important also.
Okay, I appreciate that. Now, if someone wants to read your article, where can they find it?
They can find it at the crimereport.org, crimereport.org. They can also find it on KCET website, and there's a few other places that it's appearing.
All right. Joe, we appreciate you coming on Gervie's Law. Thanks for being with us. We're obviously going to hear the other side, but I think you make some interesting points.
Thank you, Alan. Good to talk with you.
You too. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So now we need to hear the other side, and we have Professor Malina Abdullah. She's going to speak to us after the break. She's the head of the LA chapter of the Black Lives Matter. I don't think she agrees with Joe, but just stay tuned, because let's hear what she has to say. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Not available in all states.
Thank you for calling Reese and Irvy's, the future of frozen yogurt.
Are you the robot people?
Yes, ma'am. Our Froyo robot serves 7 different flavors of delicious frozen yogurt with up to 6 delicious toppings all within 60 seconds. Reese and Irvy's Froyo robots are available as a unique franchise opportunity across the United States. They work so you don't have to. Plus, we find the best locations for you.
How do I get my own Froyo robots?
Just go to FroyoFranchising.com and enter promo code 4949. That's FroyoFranchising.com, promo code 4949.
Hello, I'd like to deposit this to checking.
Fate is a fickle master.
What?
The future is uncertain.
Okay, and what's my account balance?
Ah, the horizon is cloudy. I see a long, treacherous voyage filled with great peril.
Look, can I just get a deposit slip or something?
A fortune bank teller. Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to GEICO.
I see a yellow-eyed serpent.
What?
And a low APR.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Hello, I'd like to deposit this to checking.
Fate is a fickle master.
What?
The future is uncertain.
Okay, and what's my account balance?
Ah, the horizon is cloudy. I see a long, treacherous voyage filled with great peril.
Look, can I just get a deposit slip or something?
A fortune bank teller. Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to GEICO.
I see a yellow-eyed serpent.
What?
And a low APR.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Not available in all states.
Thank you for calling Reese and Irvy's, the future of frozen yogurt.
Are you the robot people?
Yes, ma'am. Our Froyo robot serves 7 different flavors of delicious frozen yogurt with up to 6 delicious toppings all within 60 seconds. Reese and Irvy's Froyo robots are available as a unique franchise opportunity across the United States. They work so you don't have to. Plus, we find the best locations for you.
How do I get my own Froyo robots?
Just go to FroyoFranchising.com and enter promo code 4949. That's FroyoFranchising.com, promo code 4949.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. We're talking Charlie Beck resignation and a few other things. And now we want to welcome to Gervie's Law Malina Abdullah, who's professor and chair of Pan-African Studies at Cal State University, LA. And importantly, she is one of the founding members of Black Lives Matter, and she continues to serve as the Los Angeles chapter lead and has often been contributing to the national leadership. Malina, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, you were just listening to Joe Dominic, who has written an article about singing the praises, actually, of Charlie Beck, who has resigned early. He is retiring 2 years before his commission is up. And I know that you would like to, on behalf of Black Lives Matter, think that maybe your organization had something to do with him
yes.
being ousted.
Why I will not get up and dance in this studio, but we've been calling for the firing of Charlie Beck for the last 2.5 years. So the only thing that we'll celebrate is the fact that he's finally going away, that LA is free of him. And I want to lift up the activist community, the families of those who've been killed by LAPD, and organizers in Black Lives Matter and other organizations like LA Can, Stop LAPD Spying, and others really ushered this out. He was very adamant. Charlie Beck has been very adamant that he was going to serve out his second term.
Right.
And so I don't buy it for a minute that he's doing it because he wants to spend more time with his grandson. We know that we pushed him out.
Why? Why do you think that Black Lives Matter pushed him out? What was the pressure that caused him to say, I can't take this anymore, when he's been taking it for the last few years anyway?
So, I mean, I could read a lot into it. Here's my particular theory. We have a mayor who wants to run for president. The mayor is responsible for the police chief in the city. And right now, you know, LAPD under Charlie Beck has been the most murderous police department for 7 of the 8 years that Charlie Beck has run it, right? Not to mention the scandal. I heard Joe Dominic talk about how he's moved it out of a realm of scandal. But let's not forget the LA police cadet scandal that just happened. Let's not forget that again in 2017, LAPD killed more of its residents than any other law enforcement unit in the country, including NYPD, which has a population that's more than double the size, right? And so we need to remember, we also know that not just this year, but last year, they were caught misclassifying crimes in order to kind of doctor up these statistics that demonstrate lowering serious crime rates. We know that that's not true. We know that there's all kinds of things happening, purchasing $10 million worth of BMWs that have sat in a garage on taxpayer dollars. These are all things that have happened under Charlie Beck's
watch.
Well,
Joe Dominic said that there was no evidence of that. We'll wait and let the courts decide? Because you're saying, yes, there is, you know, the whistleblower suit and that there was the inflation or deflation of crime rates and safety, depending on how you look at it.
You know, but I just have to say, Alan, you're right. Who's going to, it's just a big flag when somebody retires 2 years and they do not finish their contract out. There is something wrong there.
Well, especially maybe. When he's been so adamant, I will serve out my 2 years. When we called on him to step down and called on the mayor to fire him, I do want to say with regard to the misclassification of crime, there's the whistleblower lawsuit, and there's also, if you look through the Los Angeles Police Commission records, last year they were also proven, they admitted that crimes were misclassified. They said that it was a result of human error. So LAPD admitted that there were a large number of crimes that were misclassified and said it was human error in 2016. So this is a new lawsuit, but this is an old problem.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, we had the Attorney General of Indiana on our show, Curtis Hill, and Curtis Hill talked about the real problem that he believes. He's an African American who believes that black on black crimes is really what the NFL should be protesting, and that the shooting of black people by cops is really kind of a diversion, and people should be focused on that. He gave some statistics about how many black on black incidents there were versus shootings, and then of course he brought up the fact that some of these people who were shot may have created a danger to the, at least perceived danger to the police. So how do you respond to the Attorney General of Indiana?
Well, one, I don't know the Attorney General of Indiana, and Indiana is definitely not Los Angeles or California, right? So it's a different situation here. I also want to lift up that there's incredible data that's come out that shows that LAPD killings account for 8% of the murders, the homicides in the city of Los Angeles. That's a significant number.
8%?
8%.
What is that? That is hard to believe. So you're saying that cops are killing people at the rate of 8% of all murders,
right,
in this city?
And over the last 8 years, LAPD has consistently killed, so under Charlie Beck's tenure, between 6 and 8% of the homicide. They've been responsible for that number. So I think what we have in Los Angeles, the reason LAPD isn't lifted up to be this brutal, murderous police force that it actually is they also spend more of their internal budget on public relations and spin than any other law enforcement unit in the country.
Aren't you concerned, Melina, that the fact that there is so much of the statistics thrown out, and there's a concern that if we really undercut the LAPD, who's going to protect us? Who's going to be on the streets for you? If you were, for instance, made the new commissioner, the police commissioner,
I would not take that job.
Okay, I understand. You know, but again, that's like Colin Kaepernick saying, I didn't vote in the election. He's making a stance. He's saying something. So let's talk about it. What can be done in order to protect our citizens?
I love that question. So let me say that LAPD, part of the problem is that they're gobbling up resources that should be used to address public safety more holistically. So right now, LAPD takes up 54% of the city's general fund. We know that those dollars could much better be spent if we spent them on the things that actually make communities safe. Livable wage jobs, mental health resources, permanent housing, after school programs. Out of LAPD's own mouth, they said, because they've put this entire unit to address questions of homelessness, right? LAPD actually said, we are not equipped to do this work. We are not social workers. So our solution is, let's put those dollars where they're best spent. Let's spend the money on social workers. Let's spend the money on mental health resources. Let's spend the money on housing. And then you will see crime go down. In cities like Newark, New Jersey, this is where we've seen kind of a turn and real increases in public safety and lowering of serious
crime. But
you
know, there's only so much money to go around, and then people always say, yeah, that's great. If we could put all that money into those resources, down the road, maybe we could change mentalities. But right now, we need people protected. Every community needs to be protected, especially black communities.
Yes, we do need to be protected. And you know how we're safe? We're safe when we put dollars in the things that make communities safe. You don't solve homelessness by deploying people who are armed to the hilt and who see homeless people. They actually use the term homelessness and blight. When you see people as blight, that's a problem. So what we should be doing, if you want to solve homelessness, let's divert those dollars, take those dollars back, right? And put them in the common sense approach to homelessness. Provide homes.
Turning to the Women's March for a second, you spoke last week in the Women's March, and your daughter spoke as well?
Yes.
Now, your kids have been involved with these issues. I know you have, 14 and 10 and 8-year-old?
14, now, 11, and 7.
Okay. Yeah. And you had them actually go to the LAPD and say a piece to the LAPD about—
Absolutely.
What, and you don't have a problem with that. I mean, I have some of the quotes, and you— is it okay if I read them from your kids?
Sure.
One, lots of people have died because of you. Your 10-year-old or 11-year-old now maybe told LAPD Chief Charlie Beck, "I think it's horrible that you don't care what you've done and killed so many young children." Your 7-year-old, "You're supposed to protect and serve. It's more like you're protecting and serving yourselves." How do your kids come up with those independent thoughts at those ages?
So I think it's really important to do for our children what I feel like a lot of us who are in the movement are doing, which is saying that it's not the behavior of the people who are assailed that needs to change. We need to change the system that assails and attacks us.
But that's a complicated, you know, I have 2 little kids, and, you know, one of them asked me this morning, why do people not like Donald Trump? And she's only 4 years old. And I told her, I said, you know, there's a couple of different thoughts to that. Some people do like him, some people don't. Here's why the people who don't like him don't like him. And here's like the people who do like him do like him. I'm kind of throwing it out to her, just make decisions as you go through, trying to give her a balanced approach. But when you tell kids what to say to the LAPD, isn't that kind of defeating?
But I never said I told them what to say. I did not tell them what to say. What I had them do, because this was during spring break, so let's applaud children who want to go and engage civically during their spring break. They think this is fun to go and
Absolutely.
Do their civic duty. That's, I think, a phenomenal thing for children to be doing, right? So what I did tell them is you need to write down your comments before you go speak. I don't tell them what to say. I like them to sit there and listen. I like them to observe. Another thing that's not quoted is my daughter really chastised the LA Police Commission and the police chief for not paying attention to the public during public comment. She noticed that I'm here. I'm paying attention to you. Why are you not paying attention to me?
And I noticed that, too.
Yeah, and I
Carrie,
like that.
You want to ask about the Women's March?
Well, no, I want to actually make a comment on this because my dad was an activist and I'm now an activist. And you know, I have to say I was very influenced by him. He was a, you know, he was a liberal, my mom a Republican fundraiser. So I was with both. I'm right down the middle.
You are.
Very, very right for a long time, extremely right. I'm now registered as an independent. And I have to say that I was very, very influenced by my father. You know, I was so influenced by him. We went to speeches. I spoke for him. And then I started to realize, I don't agree with some things. Not saying this, but it did. It took me to get a little older to actually start making my own assessment of things.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But I think it's great. I have to say, it's great that they're getting up and they're talking, whether it's because it's their mom and they really believe in what their
right.
mom is doing. But to get up at that age, that's going to influence them for the rest of their lives to stand up for what they believe in. And more children
and
should be doing that.
And that's the truth with the Women's March as well. People standing up. Now, your daughter stood up and spoke at the Women's March, as you did. And I've heard people had a really good reaction to your talk. And your daughter, what did she speak about?
So my daughter talked about the Black Lives Matter position in terms of standing with the women and femmes of Palestine. And so there had been another side presented earlier in the march that was pro-Israel, and she felt that it was important that, especially as a Muslim girl, that she talk about the people of Palestine. And so that's what she spoke about. And it wasn't just my daughter, but we have a part of Black Lives Matter called the Youth Vanguard, which actually I think provides an opportunity to do what you're saying, Carrie, right? Where the young people talk together. And I don't always agree with what
right.
they come
right.
up with,
right?
So did she talk about the women's rights in Palestine or that sort of thing?
Well, she just said, because we supposedly had 2 minutes to speak.
Yeah. So, well, longer than that.
So we took a little longer.
Right.
But she just spoke about needing to stand with the women and femmes of Palestine and left it at that.
Because of their rights, human rights.
Right.
So it was
absolutely
really based on the human rights of people and the way that some countries may treat the women in their country or in their territory.
Right. Well, yes. And also recognizing that Palestinians have a right to their lives and to their land and to their families. And she is a child watching what's happening to those in Palestine, is really deeply affected by that. And so it was important for her. I actually had the honor of driving the whole Youth Vanguard, 6 kids in my SUV, right?
Wow.
And listen to them kind of go back and forth about what it is they wanted to say and what it is they wanted to present.
It's amazing. I mean, yeah. I think, were you at the Women's March?
I was marching in Hungary for religious freedom.
Oh,
I just
good.
Got back in the country. So I was at another march. Because
I was at my son's interview for kindergarten. So I missed
that's
it.
That's right. I know you said that.
And
you had to go.
I was interviewing students for Brown at the same time. So I had a number of different high school students who I interviewed that day, and I missed it. But a lot of them were just really impressive. It's interesting to see at the high school level the level of understanding of world issues like you're talking
Absolutely.
About. Now, I know you want to go, and I wish we could stay talking about it. It's fascinating stuff. I wish you could stay, but I know you have to pick up your
children.
Kids.
Yes.
Yeah, because we told you we would have you out of here. Thank you. Melina Abdullah, she's professor of chair of Pan-African Studies at Cal State University, L.A. And, of course, she is the head of the L.A. chapter of the Black Lives Matter. And
I'm one of, so let me say that.
No, I know.
And believe in group-centered leadership.
Listen, you're one of the founding members, and I know you've always given all the other founding people their due as well. You didn't do this on your own.
Absolutely.
So congratulations on that, and good luck. You know, maybe we'll see someone from Black Lives Matter as the new police chief of LAPD.
No, we won't.
And if
see
it
that.
Has, it,
won't
it,
happen,
it better be a woman, too. All right, thanks. Now, you're listening to Gervie's Law. We're going to have Greg Barker on with us after the break. It's Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Talk Radio 790 KABC News Update. I'm Steve Cumming. The Michigan Attorney General has announced that an investigation has been opened into who knew what and when regarding the Olympic sexual abuse scandal involving Dr. Larry Nassar. Correspondent Jean Caceres reports from Lansing.
They said that this investigation will be independent, thorough, transparent, and prompt. And although they did not specifically say that this was a criminal investigation, what was said is that they will look to see what the facts are and where the facts take them.
Nassar also worked for USA Gymnastics as a doctor to Olympic athletes. For Dave Min, Election Day was a wake-up call. President Trump's travel ban was a catalyst. The Orange County law professor and former D.C. political hand had never seriously considered running for office and had no real organization behind him. But he's challenging Republican Representative Mimi Walters. KABC SoCal weather, mostly sunny for the rest of the afternoon with highs in the upper 60s to mid-70s. More news coming up and continuous coverage on KABC.com. I'm Steve Cumming, Talk Radio 790, KABC News.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Norm's Bigger Better Breakfasts are back. All day, every day, starting from just $6.99. Two slices of crispy hot bacon. Two perfectly cooked farm fresh eggs. Two sizzling sausage links. Hot grilled ham. Golden hash browns. And two scratch-made buttermilk hotcakes. All this for just $6.99. Yep. Norm's Bigger Better Breakfasts are back. All day, every day, but only for a limited time. Norm's Restaurants, where life happens 24/7.
Everyone needs a place in their home to call their own. This Saturday, we're talking to an expert who's got all your DIY tips to denscape that man cave. Find out more with me, Lou Manfredini, on House Smarts Radio this Saturday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The Sid Levine Show, fame and fortune in Hollywood. Sid Levine, owner of the Levine Agency for 31 years, shares his wealth of knowledge for all to hear. A must listen if you're trying to make it in Hollywood. Tune in every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Jeez, with that music, I'm going to get a headache listening to Gervie's Law.
But you don't
that
like
came
it?
On strong. Well, that's fine. It was so loud. It was in my ear.
Because that's on your side. I was getting a headache
from the last interview. I don't know about the music. It was great. I enjoyed this. I love everyone who sits in that chair. We've had so many people sitting in the chair, and here's another guy that I know I'm going to like because I've been watching, the trailer. I haven't seen his film yet because it just came out, but I was watching the trailer. I watched it a few times because it's so dense. There's so much in there, and he is Greg Barker. He is, I would say, a very well noted documentary filmmaker. In fact, Variety called him. They said, Barker creates riveting cinema. And New York Times said, a filmmaker of artistic and political consequence. And now, after coming out with Manhunt, which was the documentary about the CIA's secret war against Al-Qaeda and the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and he had Quran by Heart, which is really interesting, Ghosts of Rwanda, Sergio, all of these documentaries comes out with The Final Year, which gives an insider's perspective of the Obama presidency, especially as it relates to foreign policy, as it focuses on someone who was on our show's wife, actually. Cass Sunstein was on our show, and Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, former UN ambassador before Nikki Haley, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, and Secretary of State John Kerry, and of course, the president himself. After that introduction, Greg, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So tell us, everyone wants to know, and the film speaks for itself, but what was it like doing this project? I mean, with the president and all of these people with these most important decisions, while we're all distracted with the Trump election, you're following the president and the foreign policy people around.
Yeah. And how did you get that? That's amazing.
I just knocked on the door.
Wow. Walked right up and hey. Just knocked on the Oval Office.
My name is Michael Wolff. I'm here to do
it. Oh, that'll work.
on a personal level, as a filmmaker, it was a job of a lifetime. Because just to kind of get inside these halls of power that are normally totally closed and opaque, and what I wanted to do is capture it from a human perspective. These are like real people doing these extraordinary jobs. Whatever you think of Barack Obama and his foreign policy, it's all in there. If you like him, you'll find stuff to validate that. If you don't, you'll find stuff to validate that. But I wanted to say, this is what it is actually like, the complexities that involve, the pace of these jobs, which is unbelievable. And to kind of like make what I call an experiential film. It's not a policy film. It's a film where you can go and you get a sense.
Experience it.
This is it. Mm-hmm. This is it.
And one of the things that I read is that you were astonished that there were like 30 people who were basically making every decision and our whole world was being run. You were watching them make these decisions.
Yeah, this is inside the National Security Council in the West Wing of the White House, which is a very small space. I mean, the room that we're in right now, the studio, where they'd fill with like 7 or 8 people.
Really?
It's tiny, tiny, with low ceilings. And yet, they make all these, incredibly important decisions there. And so we were lucky enough to kind of not be part of the normal press corps who hated me because of that. And we were like, hanging out in the West Wing and at the State Department and just trying to capture moments, you know, from an emotional human perspective that we just don't normally see.
Did you need to get the clearance to do all this stuff? I know Carrie's always asking these questions.
Yes,
she's fascinated by documentary filmmakers. Like, how do you do it, and do they muzzle you, or do they tell you what you can or cannot?
And yeah, how do you get the clearance? That's unbelievable. It seems like it's unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is unprecedented in modern times. I mean, the Kennedy administration let some cameras in. But since then, no one's really done this. I mean, it was, you know, I asked and I sort of had this idea that, you know, was it possible to make like a campaign film, like the War Room but in reverse, you know, so track people, you know, during the last year in office. And as a filmmaker, a storyteller, it's got a built in narrative TikTok. They're going to leave office,
right,
you know, but to get the actual access, I mean, the bureaucracy was, completely opposed to it. And,
what do they need that?
Yeah, exactly. Why do this? And in the end, it came down to a couple people, Samantha Power, Ben Rhodes at the White House, ultimately Barack Obama, kind of taking a leap of faith and saying, we're going to try this. They had no editorial control whatsoever. We had to make sure we didn't film anything classified, but it wasn't that hard because they can't legally show us anything classified.
Right,
we didn't have clearances. So, you know, I kept a very, the biggest, challenge was to convince these people who are all very busy that we wouldn't get in the way. I wasn't, so, you know, I didn't have any lights. I had a very small crew. I filmed a lot of it myself on these very small cameras. So, you know, they're like, you know, I didn't want to stop and say, okay, now we're doing the formal interview. I just wanted to be there as things are happening.
Right.
And they're all so kind of immersed in their day-to-day jobs. They can't like say, okay, wait, we're going to like, get a different angle.
But how do you get
there.
The sound? I've been doing the documentary for 4 years, and I mean, half the stuff we can't use, and that wasn't my fault. I had somebody that I was working with. The sound was so bad on certain things that you couldn't get into.
Yeah.
You can't stop things, especially when I do a lot of politics, and when I'm talking to senators, or I'm down on the floor and I'm testifying. You can't stop things and go, here's the mic. How do you do that? How do you get sound and make it good? I realize this is a real question because that's very hard.
Yeah, I mean, well, I had an amazing sound man. A guy I flew in from, he's a U.S. citizen. He lives in Vancouver, and he was one of the best guys in the world, and I flew him in to capture that stuff. When he wasn't available, once he wasn't available, and I was filming in the White House myself.
Yeah.
And I had this wireless mic, and the Secret Service jammed it. And so the sound was terrible because I was doing sound. But which we made it work. You know, actually, Skywalker Sound did the final post.
Oh,
so
thank God.
Fix
they fixed it.
But basically, it just means it's very – you're right. As a documentary filmmaker – you know, you can get stuff on, you know, the images, but the sound, you can
do subtitles or whatever. You can title
it.
But some of the stuff literally can't use it.
It's really hard.
It's so bad.
So I want to ask you about the emotions, because I saw that you started to feel an affinity, so to speak, for instance, to Samantha Power and what she was trying to do. When you're involved and you're seeing policy unfolding in front of your eyes, do you become emotionally involved with certain people, John Kerry or Samantha Power or Barack Obama?
I would say it's more empathy rather than an affinity. You know, for me, it's like stories.
I'm sure Cass Sunstein is happy about that.
Well, I love Cass. So
he was great on the show.
Yeah, he is like such a smart
guy.
He's
brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
But so I would say that it was, you know, you just have to get them to trust. It's true in any documentary. Characters that you're filming with have to trust you. They take, like I said before, a leap of faith. Obviously, you come to like people that you're filming with most of the times, mm-hmm. but there's a very distinct, you know, line is that, you know, I'm the filmmaker. I have editorial control. But at the same time, these people are trusting me with their stories. That can be me, you know, that's a great privilege. When you're dealing with ordinary people, you know, who are opening themselves up to the cameras, I take that very seriously.
Yeah.
Public figures, they're kind of big, you know, they're grown-ups.
Did you get chummy with President Obama?
I mean, we're not like hanging out having beers, but I think, you know, we hung out. I mean, I interviewed him several times. I mean,
yeah.
But he's a very sort of kind of private, controlled, I mean, incredibly charismatic and very articulate. But he's very careful.
And you have to be.
Other people.
You have to be.
Well, Donald Trump isn't really
mm-hmm.
that. Speaking of Donald Trump, did they talk about him? Like, I want people to see this film because I think it's an important film because of the transition from the Democratic policies, so to speak, of the Obama administration to what we're seeing now with Trump.
Yeah, well, I mean, Trump's all in the film, but however, it's like a, he's like the shark in the water. So at first he doesn't appear for like till like 35 minutes in. We all know that he's going to come because it's like the last year or so.
Yeah.
And then he's and throughout they are asked, Samantha Power, Ben Rhodes, one of Obama's top aides in the film a lot, is asked repeatedly, what about Trump? And he's traveling around the world and he's like, don't worry, Hillary's going to win. And it all just sort of slowly builds. And then the poll numbers are looking, you know, different. And they're like, I don't want to think about it. If Hillary wins, if she doesn't win, I'm going to flip out. And Ben Rhodes' film says that. And then we're filming on election night with Samantha Power and Cass Sunstein in their apartment in New York, yeah. Which was the UN, U.S. sort of official residence. And, she's invited all of the, female ambassadors to the United Nations to the election night party, along with Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright.
Oh, wow.
So, evening begins one way and then, as you'd imagine, yeah. It's a very different.
And were you there at the
I
end?
I was there filming the whole way. And then we filmed
wow.
with her and everybody all the way up until the end. So we wrapped, we were in the White House the day before the inauguration, nice. Filming people pack up and wrapped the filming on 4 a.m. the morning of January 20th as Samantha Power left her.
I imagine it was like New Orleans Saints watching the Minnesota Vikings beating them on the last second when you were filming that with the election.
I wanted to, yeah.
The ten times.
Ten times.
Yeah. You can't get more feminist liberal room than that. I mean, that's, you really can't. But what did you get Obama's reaction to Trump winning?
I mean, what was extraordinary was to see, you know, I don't know what he was saying to in his most private moments, but around all of his staff, both what in moments that we filmed and what I heard later is the way he actually was talking to people. He was kind of philosophical about it. You know, he's takes the long view of history and says that, you know, there's ebbs and flows and ups and downs, and you just have to remain committed to, you know, what he sees as kind of like the arc of progress.
So interesting.
He was very interesting.
You just said that, you know, he had that controlled, were you chums? No, it was kind of a controlled environment relationship. And it's almost like you're describing that with his reaction to the election.
I think that's partly who he is. I mean, he's a very measured intellect.
Yeah.
I mean, which is interesting because it's in contrast to his ability as a campaigner. I think that's one of the frustrations people have had, Obama fans had with him as president, this guy who was such an incredible
dynamic
force on the campaign trail. Where is that? And the fact is, he's kind of both. He can do that. Yeah. He's also the constitutional law professor.
But then you had someone like Samantha Power who, you know, her whole background and becoming a U.S. citizen and everything, there's got to be a lot more emotion there. And she's been such a contrast. Nikki Haley, you know, I'm not taking politics on one side, but such a contrast in their policies, especially in the Middle East.
Yeah, and a lot of the film is about one of the core subplots is the question of what to do in Syria, which obviously for Samantha Power was a deep sort of nagging moral issue, and indeed for all of them. And I think that that's going to be one of the things that haunts them going forward is did they do enough and could they have stopped the carnage earlier? And in the last year, John Kerry, who's a major presence in the film, is trying to negotiate an international sort of peace deal, which obviously doesn't work. But with working closely with the Russians, and of course now we know, you know, what was going on behind the scenes too with Russia.
Well, we don't really know.
Well,
I mean,
maybe
that's your next film. Did anything on Russia come up? Because I've read that, you know, it's really tough, especially with the focus that you had to have that kind of diversion.
Yeah, I mean, it was lurking in the background. I mean, a lot of it was still classified. I think it came out right near the end. But I think now when you look at what, at that last year, through the lens of what we now know, it has a, everything, you know, they were, trying to work with Russia to kind of get a deal in Syria. And arguably being outplayed, you know, at the same time, you know, confident that they could somehow contain or mitigate Russia's role in the election. And, you know, it's one of these issues that's gonna haunt them. And in the film, Ben Rhodes says, you know, basically that, we misjudged, you know, Putin and his priorities.
Yeah. And I think that obviously history bore that out, not only in your film, but after your film.
Yeah, and then they really thought that that Clinton was going to win. I mean, so there's in the film, there's a big set piece near the end, Obama's last foreign trip. He goes to Greece and tours the Acropolis and gives this big speech. The speech was going to be about democracy. On the steps of the Parthenon.
Yeah.
They were going to point a finger at Russia and talk about, you know, how dare you try to interfere with our democracy. After the election, the optics all, the speech ended up inside.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. So is there anything, cause we only have a few more minutes, but is there anything when you look back at the film that you would have done differently, or do you sit back and are you just kind of like the proud parent and say, here, everyone, see what I experienced in a year?
I would have known the outcome of the election. That's, and then we could have filmed things in slightly different
ways.
But I think, you know, we were really along for the ride. So I thought, I mean, I look at it and I'm very satisfied. And it plays for an audience now in a sort of very unique way which is exciting as a filmmaker, is that there's two narratives. There's the story of on the screen. And then there's a counter narrative that's going on in our heads right now. And whatever you think about Obama or Trump, we are in a different world. And so every scene by scene, you constantly have this really sort of interesting conversation going on in your head, which is why it's so exciting to release the film.
You know, it's interesting. We only have a couple minutes.
I have to ask this question.
Go ahead.
It's about documentaries in general and knowing that you're going to be with the president of the United States. You're going to follow his last year. Do you at that point go out and say, hey guys, I have a film. I already got, you know, clearance with the President of the United States. Make your offers. Do you get the money up front or do you wait and you wait for the offer afterward?
We had the money up front.
So that was a pretty easy thing.
Yeah, HBO put up the money. They took a big leap of faith. It'll be on HBO in late May. And Magnolia Pictures is releasing it nationwide now in theaters here in LA at the Pico, Landmark on Pico, and nationwide as well, and also on iTunes, where it's number one documentary.
Congratulations. Yeah,
I'm glad you said it, that how people can see it. The reviews have been phenomenal. In fact, I heard Barack Obama actually liked it as well. At least he didn't say anything that he was upset about.
They liked it. I mean, then he's not going to come out and publicly promote it, but he liked it. We had right before we did had our opening at the Toronto Film Festival, I had a private screening for a lot of the Obama folks so they could see it. And, it was like, I mean, it was very emotional. Because it's like a
reunion kind
reunion,
of thing.
And it's
back.
Very emotional, yeah. But also there's a measure of hope in it as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And, you know, the reviews talk about there's something for everyone. This is not political propaganda. It's something, it's experiential as you talk about. And for politics, you can look at it in any way you want. I know a lot of people want to see it. Here in LA, they can see it now.
Absolutely. Right now at the Landmark on Pico, and I think it's going to be expanding to some other cinemas in the area, and also on iTunes, Amazon Prime, other on-demand platforms.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Anywhere.
Well, congratulations. I mean, I can see on your face that it was a really exciting experience, and you're so passionate about talking about it. We appreciate Greg Barker. The film is called The Final Year. Thanks for coming on Gervie's Law today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for another, wow, this was quite a
show.
I'm just so much more relaxed now. It just really, because I love documentaries and that's what really relaxed me. Anytime I'm stressed, I watch a documentary. So it's got to be The Final Year. That's the final moment for Gervie's Law. We will be back next week, though. It's not the final moment, just for this week. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
They say, want a new wireless plan? Gotta buy a new phone. At Simple Mobile, we say, just bring your own phone. Then pop in a Simple Mobile SIM card and boom. You've got 30-day unlimited plans starting at just $25 with nationwide coverage on a lightning-fast 4G LTE network, all with no contract. You can keep it complicated, or you can mobile simple with Simple Mobile.
Available nationwide at Best Buy, Simple Mobile dealers, and authorized retailers. See the latest terms and conditions of service at simplemobile.com.
When you join the Fuel Rewards program at Shell and get instant gold status, you'll save on every fill, every day.
But you'll feel like you just won a dance-off competition that saved the world.
That's what it feels like to have gold status with the Fuel Rewards program at Shell. With gold status, you'll save 5 cents with every gallon from the first fill. Download the Fuel Rewards app, join, and start saving today.
Restrictions apply. Active Gold status required. Introductory offer valid for 6 months after activation. Limit 20 gallons at participating Shell stations. See fuelrewards.com/gold for full details.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
This show furnished by Rowan Gervey and Wynn.